Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I'm a resident. This is episode 234 of the Divine Intervention Podcasts. And in this podcast, I'll be continuing the Clean SP curriculum, basically the changes that are coming to the USMLE exam. I think they've either started this month or they're coming next month, one of the two. And today I'm going to be talking about two kinds of errors that are highlighted in the USMLE content outline. So I'm going to be talking about medication errors. And if I see that the podcast is not getting too long, I'll talk about transition of care errors. So those are the two big things I'm going to talk about. So let's just jump right into it. So basically, a medication error is any error that occurs from the time a clinician prescribes a medication to the time where the medication is delivered to the patient. And there are some terms I think probably useful to try to understand before we jump into how to prevent these medication errors. And again, these are all things that could easily be tested on a USMLE exam. One thing that's important to understand is what an adverse drug event is, right? So an adverse drug event, like the name says, right? Basically, it's just any kind of harm that is experienced by a patient as a result of being exposed to drugs, right? Pretty self-explanatory. And for the most part, about half of these adverse drug events are actually preventable. So for the purposes of the USMLE exam, it would be important for you to understand some risk factors for, you know the way your friends at the NBME, they really love their risk factors, right? So you definitely want to make sure you know the risk factors for adverse drug events. One is something known as a polypharmacy. In fact, polypharmacy, this is very high yield to know. Polypharmacy is the biggest risk factor for adverse drug events. I'll say that again. This is super high yield to know. Polypharmacy is the biggest risk factor for adverse drug events on NBME exams, right? Basically, polypharmacy means you're getting more medications than is clinically less necessary, right? So like you see people taking 5 minutes, but you're like, man, I could maybe cut off two of these medications. That's polypharmacy. Right. Also, being elderly is an important risk factor, right? Because as people get older, they tend to get more medical problems, you know, and then they tend to get more meds for those medical problems. Another risk factor is also like just being a pediatric patient, because remember, peds, many of these peds drugs, they have like weight based dosing. So you need to do a little more math to like figure out the correct medication dose. And then also having like decreased health literacy, right? Because again, many of these drug instructions kind of hard to understand for people that are not in healthcare, right? And also there's another risk factor is like having like drugs that look alike, like the tablets look very similar or the drugs sound very similar, right? Like for example, right? Like if you're looking at like these, diabetes drugs, right? Like glipizide and glimepiride, right? Those drugs sound extremely similar, right? So like similar sounding medications, those are things you kind of want to be careful of. And the thing is, with regards to the elderly, there are some screening tools you can use to make sure that you're almost like predicting their risk of an adverse drug event from taking a medication. Back in the day, and you may still see this on exams, there's this thing known as the Beers criteria. So BEERS, the Beers criteria that was previously used. Just commit that to memory. You don't need to know like specifics of that. But there's a newer one, right, that you may also see on your test that is now being used and is shown to be a little better than the Beers criteria. It's called the STOP, STOPP. So two P's after the, like basically two P's in the STOP, right? So STOP criteria, it's like screening tool of older persons for inappropriate prescriptions. That's a newer set of criteria that's to be used. And the thing is, with these medication errors, you actually want to know something I call like hotspot medications, right? So these are, again, easily testable concepts. Essentially, there are four drugs that are responsible for about 50% of adverse drug events in the healthcare industry, right? And those four drugs are insulin, warfarin, the antiplatelet agents like aspirin and clopidogrel, and also the opioids. So insulin, warfarin, antiplatelet agents like aspirin and clopidogrel and opioids, right? They're responsible for about 50% of adverse drug events that happen in healthcare. And I mean, like, there are just some rules that you maybe want to keep at the back of your mind as well, right? Like benzodiazepines, in general, on NBME exams, you don't want to prescribe them to the elderly, right? And also, if a person is, for example, having like a dental procedure or having like a low risk surgical procedure, you don't want to prescribe opioids for those patients. That's something that's high yield to know for exams. And the thing is, I think the best way to frame how to prevent medication errors is to kind of go through like a four step pathway of how a medication goes from the clinician that initially prescribed it to the patient, right? I feel like if we talk along those pathways and then talk about how you can prevent medication errors along those different pathways, then you have like a nice system in your mind for keeping this stuff straight for the exam. So the thing is basically, right, for a medication to go from clinician to the patient, first the medication has to be ordered, right? So you need to order that medication, you need to prescribe that medication. And then after that, that medication order has to be transcribed, right? So basically like the pharmacist that's like looking at the order, like, oh, you're seeing 30 milligrams per day for 60 days. And then the pharmacist then has to dispense the medication. The mnemonic I use is OTDA, right? So you order the medication first, you transcribe the medication. So that's like the pharmacist receiving the information. And then the pharmacist has to dispense the information, dispense the medication, right? That's the D. And then the A means that the medication has to be administered. It can be by a nurse or by a caregiver, stuff like that, right? And one good thing is electronic health records. They've actually helped with this whole process of ordering and transcribing of prescription orders because, you know, like back in the day, people will write down medications, they'll write things down by hand, right? You've already introduced the source of error right there with the handwriting of the clinician or the nurse or whatever, right? So that's one thing that has been very helpful, right? But I think let's maybe go by step, by one of those OTD steps, and kind of talk about how you can decrease medication errors along those lines, right? So the first one relates to ordering, right? So when a person is when you're ordering medications, right, as a clinician, right, you want to prescribe conservatively, right? Again, you want to try to use the least amount of medication to get the most amount of effect, right? And all these high risk drugs in the elderly, you know, you want to be careful with those, right? And if, for example, a medication is known to cause you know, like a lot of side effects, or like this person's condition can get better without being treated, right? Don't give those people medications, right? So, you know, as the ordering clinician, right, prescribe conservatively. And if you notice, I'm using the word clinician. I'm trying to avoid the word provider. The word provider, just in generally medicine, is a derogatory term for physicians. So as med students, I'll encourage you to not use that. You could get chewed out in the hospital if you did that. So don't use the word provider, use the word clinician. That's a much better term. Or use the word physician, right? You're a doctor, you're not a provider. There's all these reasons why that's the case. I'm not going to go into that. This is not a political discussion. Okay, so basically, right, so ordering, right, again, you want to prescribe conservatively, right? And also the use of computerized order entry systems that are tethered to a clinical decision support system is very helpful. So what do I mean by that? Basically, like being able to generate like medication orders and send it electronically to the pharmacy instead of having to rely on your handwriting. And then a clinical decision support system is like something that scans the medical record and sees if there's any like patient factors that may make you like prescribe one medication or not prescribe this medication or prescribe a certain dose, right? So say, for example, like a clinical decision support system is like, oh, if a patient, let's say like in the medical record, it's been scanned and it's been shown that, oh, this patient has like a valvular cause of their AFib, right? Then warfarin is the drug you'd want to prescribe as anticoagulation for those people. It wouldn't make sense to give them any of the novel oral, like the NOACs, right? Like the novel oral anticoagulants under those circumstances. And then another thing that can also help you reduce a medication error at the point of ordering is also doing a medication reconciliation. Basically, at every transition of care, like as you're going from one clinician to the other, or from a clinician to a nurse or whatever, you always want to do some kind of medication reconciliation. The primary person that should be doing med recs is the pharmacist, but as a physician, you have no excuse. As a nurse, you have no excuse. Every person that is involved in a patient's care should make it a point of duty to do medication reconciliation. And the thing is, I can envision MBME questions where they talk about these different OTD steps and they'll say, oh, which of the following interventions is most likely to reduce the risk of medication error at this step in medication and prescription, right? So again, you want to kind of keep track of these different steps as I logically go through them, right? So I've talked about everything I want to do with ordering. Right now, from the transcribing process, right, I've kind of talked about like the major things, right? Again, a computerized order entry system. Again, you want to try to remove human handwriting as much as is possible, right? The only problem with these computerized systems is that, you know, sometimes there are workarounds to these systems. And the thing is, there's also like this increased cognitive load that physicians and clinicians need to expend in dealing with these things, right? I mean, like, I know Epic and Cerner and all these things, they've done awesome, awesome, outstanding jobs. Like, big congratulations to those companies. But having, like, worked in healthcare systems where, again, document, 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 and you have to click through this, click through that, that thing introduces in ridiculous amounts of mental fatigue to the process. So those are kind of like the big things with the transcribing process. Now let's go to the D, the dispensing process, right? So the dispensing process, what are some things you can do to reduce medication errors under these situations? One is a clinical pharmacist must oversee the process, right? A clinical pharmacist must absolutely oversee the process. And then another thing you can use, and this is something that, I don't know, I will be surprised if this doesn't show up on an NBM exam, is this thing known as tall man lettering, right? So tall man lettering. Basically, tall man lettering is where if you have like drugs that are similar sounding or drugs that look alike, you take part of that drug's name and write it in uppercase letters to make it more obvious to the person that is handling those medications. And especially for like high-risk medications, you want to try to use like automated dispensing cabinets, right? So that you can kind of get like standardized amounts. I know this is something that's done quite frequently by anesthesiologists, right? So something to keep in mind. And then if we go from the D to the A, right? So the administration process. The administration process, the big thing, like big super high yield thing you want to know, is this thing known as the five rights rule. The five rights rule, right? So the five rights rule means you want to make sure that you want to give the right medication, you want to give the right dose, you want to give it at the right time, you want to give it by the right route, and you want to give it to the right patient. This is very important. I'll say that again. You want to give the right medication at the right dose, at the right time, through the right route to the right patient. Those are the five R's. That's why it's called the five rights rule. Okay. Another thing that can also help is if you use like barcodes, right? So like those things you have to scan. Barcodes kind of ensure that you're giving the medication to the right patient at the right dose and is the right medication, right? Another thing that has also been shown to help is you want to minimize interruptions in the process of medication administration. So if, for example, as a clinician, you're seeing a nurse administer medication, do not interrupt her. Let her administer the medication first before you do those kinds of things. And then another thing that also helps, especially with IV medications, is to use a smart infusion pump. The use of smart infusion pumps helps significantly with decreasing the risk of medication errors when you're giving IV meds, right? And say, for example, you know, you're sending a patient home and this patient takes like tons and tons of medications. You want to try to use something that's called like a multi-compartment medication device. Basically, like you have like different, like it's like you have this big box of all the patient's meds, and then you have these little boxes where like each separate med is placed in, especially for people that are going to like long-term acute care. That's usually something very good to do. And then, you know, one other thing you can do on the part of the clinician administering these medications is like just good patient education, right? Just spend the time. Don't spend 30 seconds on your discharge process with the patient. Go over stuff with them. And in fact, I suspect I'll have time to talk about transition of care errors. I'll talk about some things you can do that can really help with patient care, patient education, right? And just, I guess, some other key things, right? Again, don't forget that IV meds tend to be more prone to medication errors than oral medications, right? Because IV meds, you have to do all these calculations, milligrams per liter, by weight of the patient, over what time interval do you want to administer, blah, 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 right? So, you know, it kind of takes a lot out of you, right? And again, the most common medication error is administering medications at the wrong time. It's very high yield to know. The most common type of medication error is administering medications at the wrong time. That's very high yield to know, right? And then just a few quick words on like opioid safety, right? So the opioid safety, I mean, I mentioned opioids as one of those four drugs. I hope you remember the others, right? Insulin, warfarin, right? Antiplatelet drugs like aspirin and clopidogrel and opioids, right? So opioids, right? Like opioid safety is kind of a big topic these days in healthcare, right? And the root cause of opioid problems, right? Root cause of like opioid and medication errors is just an overprescribing behavior on the part of many physicians, right? In fact, in the US, I think there was like a study or something that was done that shows that the US prescribes 80, like of the prescription opioids that are like, you know, sent out to patients or prescribed to patients, the US was responsible for like 80% of the world's prescription opioids, right? And in fact, they did a study that every person in every country of the world could get a four weeks supply of opioids per year, just based on the prescribing behavior of opioid, like the prescribing behavior attached to opioids in this country. So it's a huge problem, right? The thing is, in general, on NBME exams, you want to give opioids if a person has like acute traumatic pain, right? Let's say they had like a bone fracture, or they were in a big car accident or something. Those people deserve opioids, right? Or if a person has like cancer-related pain, right, you can use opioids for that. Or if a person has shortness of breath and they have cancer, right, like they have a malignancy, morphine is the drug of choice under those circumstances. So what are some things you can do to reduce like these, like to encourage opioid safety, right? You want to use prescription drug monitoring programs, especially at the state level. That's very important to know, right? And as a clinician, you want to use like a short course of opioids, right? For example, I remember for me during my intern year, I rarely gave patients more than 3 days worth of opioids. And I rarely give patients opioids, period, on discharge, right? And also you want to use opioids only when it's clinically warranted, right? So you don't want to give patients opioids for headaches. That is not a good thing to do, right? That is not a good thing to do. It does not help. If a patient has pain because they have an infection, giving an opioid is not a good idea either. Give anti-inflammatory medications like NSAIDs. They've been shown to be superior to opioids under those kinds of circumstances. So let me slide right into transition of care errors. And basically, what is a transition of care? A transition of care is basically where you're moving a patient from one healthcare setting to the other, right? So like if a patient is moving from the ambulance to the emergency room, or from the emergency room to the wards, or from the wards to the ICU, or from the emergency room to the ICU, or from the ambulance to the ICU, right? Or going from the ICU back to a ward, or going from the hospital to the home, or from a hospital to like a long-term care facility. Those things are all transitions of care, right? And the thing is, if you do transitions of care poorly, right, the two most likely complications are, one, you will increase the readmission rate, and two, there's also a high risk of adverse drug events. So what are some things you can do to minimize transition of care errors? One thing you want to do is to try to use clearly written discharge instructions, and make sure you've done a medication reconciliation before you've done this, right? Make sure you write clearly written, clearly well-explained discharge instructions to the patient, or if they are like, you put like very good detailed documentation that's being sent to long-term care facilities or nursing homes and stuff like that. And again, make sure that these instructions are easy to understand. Most EMRs have EMRs doesn't matter, but like they have like easy to read versions of patient care instructions, right? And then you also want to make sure that you've arranged follow-up. This is very high yield to know. If before a patient leaves the hospital, make sure that their follow-up has been properly coordinated, like definitive follow-up, like go to this physician at this address, at this date, at this time. If you can coordinate that before the patient leaves the hospital, that reduces the risk of a transition of care error, right? And then the third thing is using teach back, right? Using teach back. So basically, after you've explained the discharge instructions to the patient or to the receiving facility, have them explain it back to you, right? That has been shown to reduce, propagated as a means of decreasing our transition of care errors, right? And also using a checklist, like a discharge checklist, is something that has also been propagated and is something you want to do on an MBME to reduce the risk of our transitional errors, right? So transition of care errors, right? Because if you have like a checklist, right, you're like, oh, I covered this, 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 and this with the patient, right? That really helps. Now, one thing I think I want to talk about is handoffs, like patient safety in the context of handoffs. So the thing is, why are handoffs, accurate handoffs, important? The thing is, as a physician or as a clinician, you cannot be in the hospital forever, right? I mean, like, you can't be in the hospital for like 72 hours straight, right? You know, that's a recipe for like, you know, like fatigue, and then you make all these errors because, again, we're human beings, we're not robots, right? So unfortunately, one problem that creates is something known as discontinuity of care. So the thing is, because there's a lot of handoffs in the world of medicine, you want to try to make that process as accurate and as neat as possible. And there are certain things you want to use on MBME exams, some specifics you want to know on MBME exams with regards to reducing, like making the handoff process as error-free as possible. The first thing you want to do is you want to have well-written instructions that you're handing off to the other team. That's one. The second thing you want to do is you want to make sure that it's done in a separate environment that is free of interruptions. That's very important. You don't want to do it in a place where like, or like do it in like different places. No. You want to have it in a place like a standardized place that is free of interruptions, right? And then probably the highest yield thing you want to keep at the back of your mind with this is you want to use something known as IPASS. So the letter I and then PASS, the IPASS method, right? So what does the I stand for? When you're doing handoffs, you want to accurately communicate the illness severity. Like, is this patient someone that you need to watch closely? Or is this a patient that's fine? Or is this a patient that, you know, could become high risk very quickly, right? That's the I. The P is for patient summary, right? So you want to essentially give like a short background on the patient. I'm not saying to give like a whole presentation, just kind of give a short background on the patient. And then that would definitely help. And then, so like a patient summary, that's the P. And then the A stands for action list, right? So an action list are the specific things that the new team are supposed to do during the course of their shift, right? You want to communicate that clearly. And then the first S stands for situation awareness, right? So basically, like, it's like the situation awareness involves like if-then statements. Like if, for example, the patient's blood pressure goes above 150 over 90, give hydralazine, right? If above so and so threshold, then give this, right? In fact, I remember during my transitional year, sometimes when I'm putting in like some medication orders, I'll put under the note like, if this, do this. If this, then do that, right? If then statements are very helpful for situational awareness. And then the S is synthesis by receiver. Basically, this is almost like teach back from the new team. So the new team, they're essentially teaching back like the key components, or they are summarizing the key components of the patient's case just to make sure that everyone is on the same page, right? And again, the thing is, if clinicians are communicating with each other, or if a clinician is communicating with a nurse, again, read back is something that is very helpful, right? Read back is just basically like teach back, but in this case, it's clinician to clinician communication as against teach back, which is clinician to patient communication, right? So that's how you have to know. And then the last thing I'll talk about is the SBAR method in conversation between healthcare practitioners, right? So SBAR, S-B-A-R, right? It's very useful for communications, especially between nurses and clinicians, right? Nurses and physicians, right? So what does SBAR stand for? So the S stands for like situation, right? So let's say, for example, you want to communicate information about a patient. The S stands for situation. You want to essentially describe what's going on. Let's say, oh, this patient's blood pressure is going down. This patient is deteriorating. And then the B stands for background. You want to give like, just like in two or three sentences, what is like some key background on this patient, right? So like, for example, you can see this patient has a history of MIs and they've been having recurrent ventricular tachycardias, right? And then the A is your assessment, right? So like, what do you think is going on with the patient right now? You could say, I'm beginning to see ST elevations on telemetry, right? Like, what's your professional conclusion based on what you're seeing? And then the R is for recommendation. And basically, the R is where you tell the clinician what you want them to do for you. Let's say, for example, it's a physician. You're like, I want you, the cardiologist, to come down and evaluate the patient, right? So that's what SBAR stands for. S is for situation, B is for background, A is for assessment, and R is for recommendation. So if you know these things, if you know all I've talked about in this podcast, I suspect you should be able to answer pretty much any medication error or transition of care error question you may see on your test. And as I do at the end of every podcast, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for many exams for step 1, step 2 CK, step 2 CS, and step 3, preclinical med school exams, third-year shelf exams. If you're a medicine resident, I need tutoring for the if you're a medicine or a peds resident, I need tutoring for your in-training exams or for your board exams. I offer tutoring for all those things. And then, what else do I want to say? And I do two separate things, right? So I do these things called booster courses. It's 20 hours for step 1, 20 hours for step 2 CK, 20 hours for step 3. Basically, we review the most knows, the highest of the high yields for these respective exams. It's like in an integrated format. It's either like 21-hour sessions or 10 2-hour sessions. And we basically review the most knows, like integrated format, Q&A format for these exams. Again, many people have had very nice score increases after going through these booster courses. And then I also offer this thing called longitudinal tutoring where, you know, if you're starting off med school or you're starting off third year, I'll kind of tutor you for all your block exams or all your shelf exams. But at the same time, I'm also tutoring you for your upcoming USMLE exam. Again, I've done this with people. They found it to be extremely helpful. And then I do like some coaching with regards to like the application process, right? So if you're a med student applying to residency, so like an ERAS application, or a college student applying to med school, so like an AMCAS application. Again, I have tons of experience with helping people that, you know, like personal statements, recommendation letters, mock interviews by specialty. I've worked with people from many specialties. You know, like putting your application together nicely. Again, I've worked with tons of people. If you have like a tricky application, like low scores, no research, foreign medical graduate, graduated from med school a long time ago, or you have like something odd about your application that you need to explain away, just reach out to me. Again, I've worked with people in tricky situations, and the vast majority of people I've worked with have pretty much all matched their first choices. So if that's something you're interested in, and I've actually been on an admissions committee before, so I know how these games are played. I know how to make you put your best foot forward. So if that's something you're interested in, please do feel free to reach out to me. And please, if you also have like a college buddy that needs tutoring for like any of the MCAT subjects or any of the pre-med subjects, reach out to me and I'll be happy to point them in the right direction. And then please subscribe to the YouTube channel. The YouTube channel is called Divine Intervention USMLE Podcasts and Videos. I'll post videos periodically to that YouTube channel. And then please subscribe to the WordPress website, is Divine Intervention Podcasts with an S at the end, .com. And I also have these podcasts on Spotify, on Google Play, on Apple Podcasts. So please subscribe. That's always very helpful. And you know, if there are any specific podcasts you want me to make, just shoot me an email. Or if you want to reach out to me on these, the one-on-one tutoring I offer, you can either reach out to me through the website, or you can send me an email at divineinterventionpodcasts@gmail.com. And then the last thing I want to talk about today, so my life lesson for today is the importance of using checklists. The importance of using checklists, or should I call them maybe algorithms? The thing is, clinically in medicine, or let me put it this way. In general, if you want to accomplish anything in life that involves many moving parts, and you want to be able to accomplish it with very high fidelity, you want to use checklists. You want to use you want to have an approach to things. This is one thing, and I suspect that I'll probably in the very near future make a podcast on some of these things, like rounding efficiently or pre-rounding efficiently or writing your notes efficiently or seeing your admissions efficiently. But one thing that has helped me tremendously, like this was almost like my approach to every new thing in med school, during my third year rotations, during my intern year, where I was doing like ICU rotations and all that stuff. One thing that I found to be helpful is, the first 2 or 3 days of a new rotation, I spent a lot of time observing things. Just observing. And then as I observed people doing things and doing it well, I then came up with my own checklist, with my own approach, with my own mental model, with my own algorithm for dealing with those things. So this was almost like a constant throughout most of my rotations. The first 2-3 days of a rotation, it may take me a really long time to get things done, because I'm observing and creating my mental model and checklist. But I noticed once I created that checklist, I then committed that checklist to memory, and then I used it with every patient for every situation. And that increased my efficiency significantly. Again, I'm not trying to say this to boast, but I remember in my intern year, even as an ICU, when I had my ICU rotations, I may sometimes have like 6-7 patients in my care. Again, obviously, it depends on many factors like the severity of their condition. And I could be done with pre-rounding, writing my notes, putting in orders, interfacing with the nurses, seeing the patients, everything in like 2 hours or less, right? So that kind of efficiency comes when you have a checklist approach. Even in taking exams, I have approaches I used to take in exams. And when I tutor people, right, I almost like make like a mental checklist for them to follow when they're taking exams, so that you take all the emotion out of the process, and then you are essentially like super, super, super efficient with that process. So I will encourage you, like for many things in life, try to develop a checklist, try to develop a mental model, an algorithm. It usually does help. So thank you for listening to this podcast. I will continue with this Clean SP curriculum, and I will see you in the next podcast. Thank you for listening. Have a wonderful weekend. Stay safe and practice social distancing. God bless you. Thank you.